Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me? That's a bloody stupid question, isn't it? Of course, if you couldn't hear me, you wouldn't. Usual word, do make sure your mobile phones are on. I'd hate you to miss an important call just because... as you'll notice, we're one person light today. Well, we're not one person light. We don't have Charles Kennedy. Not a total surprise, but a great shame nonetheless. But instead, we're delighted to have his fellow Scot, Joe Swinson, who's just become deputy leader of the Scottish Liberal Democrats. And if I didn't work for The Guardian, I'd say she's about to get married. It was another course for congratulation, but because I do, this is obviously completely irrelevant to her political career. And normally I make a lot of cheap jokes at this point, but it seems to me we've got far too much to discuss today. So let's start off with the other two folk here. Obviously, you know Chris Huhne, who's something to do with the government, and you also know Andrew Adonis, who's something to do with the last government, but is now here as the director of the Institute for Government, not to be confused with the government.
Yes.
Chris made the mistake of arriving last and so has been told that he has to start. Chris Huhne.
Well, thank you, Simon. On the sound principle that the absent are always guilty, I'm starting off on this. The subject I was set, and I think that's always appropriate for a Guardian fringe, was politics after the election, never the same again. And I'm a bit fed up, frankly. I'm a bit fed up with being asked by journalists who ought to know better. That what has happened in the general election is something that we in the Liberal Democrats have been actually working for years, because we believe in multi-party politics. We want parties to cooperate together. We want coalition government to be the norm, as it is in every other European country. And yet, my former profession, and the lobby correspondents in particular, probably because a necessary qualification for being a lobby correspondent is that you should be innumerate and therefore not actually be able to understand cephalological articles which spell out the actual electoral landscape that's been going on. You have to immediately jump to the executive summary provided by Professor Curtis. The reality is that the trends which have brought us into government have been at work in the British system since 1970. I mean, in 1970, our predecessor party had six MPs. They could all fit in a London taxi cab, and that remained the case until the late and lamented Sir Cyril Smith was elected. Good to see there's enough grey hair to get that gag. So I very firmly believe that we should resist all of Fleet Street's rather pathetic attempts to squeeze us back into a two-party box marked, are you going to fight the next election with the Conservatives? The answer is, of course, no. We are going to fight the next election as an independent party in exactly the same way as after we did a deal with Labour in the Scottish Government, we fought as an independent party. And, by the way, we won more seats and more votes, even though there was a incessant stream of the commentariat who told us that junior partners are always beaten up in government, never get anything out of it, they always run rings around you, you'll end up losing votes and losing seats and losing power. We'll talk to Jim Wallace about that. It's nonsense. The reality is we need a little more confidence in our own position, a little more confidence in our philosophical underpinnings, because remember, we are also the last great ideological party. We are the only party that can claim a 19th century ism that is as relevant today as it was when it was enunciated by John Stuart Mill in his works on liberty. Socialism, what is socialism? Socialism is best defined by Herbert Morrison as what Labour governments do. And it's got worse since then, because we don't even know what Labour governments do. Conservatism has always been a craving for power and a respect for authority and a defence of privilege. Liberalism is the only of one of the creeds still out there fighting, and it's going to go on fighting. Every other northwest European country, most European countries have not a two-party system, but a three-party system and, sotto voce, Caroline Lucas, sometimes even a four-party system with the Greens as well. But the reality is that multi-party politics is here to stay, and we need to play our part in making sure we get that message across. I'm proud of it. I think this is a necessary part of the blooding of our party, is to go into coalition. It's what we've worked for, it's what we've striven for, and we've got to show that we can make a success of it, because we've got to go into the next election proud of our achievements and offering the electorate something different and new. And if we do both of those things, we're going to get more votes, more seats, and more power to put our Liberal vision into practice.
And, Andrew, your party was dispossessed in May. What do you think of the coalition so far?
Well, 23 years ago, I was Chris's campaign manager when he was standing in Oxford West and Abingdon. He may be slightly relieved he didn't actually continue in Oxford West and Abingdon until this year, or else he might not be available to be a cabinet minister at the moment. But he's lost none of his campaigning zeal in the interim. It's 15 years since I've been at a Lib Dem conference. As I came into the entrance hall, I saw all of my old friends from then, just 15 years older, but there seems to be rather a larger set of people here and more people at the stands and all that, which is the great advantage that comes to you from being in government. You should take advantage of it while it lasts. Your conferences make far more money when you're in government and far more people want to come to them. And I hope that continues while you're here. I'm here wearing my Institute for Government hat as director. I can't resist the short party political broadcast. We've just produced a pamphlet. I've got some copies, not, I'm afraid, enough for everyone here, but anyone who wants them afterwards, on the working of the coalition, which looks in a technical way at how you best support a junior partner in a coalition based on the work we've done looking at the last 4 months. It has a lot of practical things to say that I think may all be useful to the Lib Dems, in particular how you better support the office of Deputy Prime Minister, which is a real and functioning office when you have a coalition, and how you also make the coalition an effective governing force in terms of the effective working of a coalition within departments, the need for midterm reviews, how you resolve issues of dispute between the partners, which Jo will have more to say on from her own experience too. So there's a technical question about making a coalition government technically successful, and those are issues that we at the IFG are looking at. However, this coalition, let's be clear, this coalition, I mean, Chris talked about isms. Actually, social democracy is still pretty alive and functioning when I last looked, and it has a strong infusion in terms of its ideology into your party. Liberalism itself has changed its face innumerable times since the 19th century. The liberalism of John Stuart Mill that Chris was talking about, you would not want to see, most of you in this hall, back again, which is freedom from, not freedom to. Mill would have been aghast at many of the things that social liberals stand for today. The truth is that all ideologies over time adapt to the circumstances around them and a changing view of society, and that's as true of liberalism as it is of social democracy and indeed conservatism. The big test for this coalition, though, won't be a technical test, it'll be a policy test. In policy terms, can you and the Conservatives, over a governing term, put together a policy prospectus that works? Now, having been myself part of the coalition negotiations, but for a different party, let me just give you my view on the policy tests that you face. There were three distinct parts of the negotiation that took place, which led to the formation of this government, and in parallel, there, of course, were discussions that might have led to the formation of a different government. There was the debate on constitutional reform, where the deal that you did with the Conservatives was a genuine compromise. They agreed to a referendum on the alternative vote. You agreed to, in terms of big things that matter, you agreed to the single electoral quota and the redrawing of all parliamentary boundaries by the next election. Now, my reading of it on the single electoral quota and the redrawing of all parliamentary boundaries by the next election is that doesn't work well for you. That's probably a net negative. So a lot depends upon this alternative vote referendum. And it looks to me as if D-Day there for you is going to be the referendum day next May. On there then a whole set of other issues, I'm leaving the economy till last, which were discussed, where there was a genuine compromise. The Conservatives have given ground, and we would have done too if the Labour Party had continued in government, on liberal issues to do with civil liberties, where the repeal bill and your commitments have been substantially recognised in the coalition. You've given a lot of ground on other issues. You've given ground on ones which, actually, I'm delighted you've given ground on because they're close to my heart. You've given ground practically on the entirety of education policy, moving towards the policies which I was busy pursuing as a minister, including academies, tuition fees and other things which you weren't supporting before. And indeed, I think you didn't support in your debate this morning. But you've given ground on those. Chris has now become a born-again convert to nuclear power, which I'm glad to see. Because I'm glad to see that because I don't see any future for this country in terms of energy independence and security unless we bite that bullet, and the last government had started to do so. And even on the nuclear deterrent, well, I understand there's a great argument going on about dates, the date at which you're going to agree to the replacement of Trident. Well, whatever the date is, it's a decision which, my own view as a member of the last government is that that is a decision in the public interest and it's the right decision to take, and of course that means compromise on your part. But as I say, the Tories have given ground on other issues. However, neither, I think, so far as the public is concerned, neither the constitutional issues nor these other issues are going to be critical. The AV referendum may be critical for you as a party if it were lost next year. That could be hugely difficult for you as a party. The critical issue, let's be clear, is deficit reduction. The thing on which this government will stand or fall is whether you can carry the country and carry your party on what was essentially an agreement on the core economic agenda in discussion in the election to go with the Conservatives, to go for the elimination of the structural deficit in this Parliament, which meant a very significant addition both to the cuts that would have been on offer if Labour had continued, and whether once the crucial spending review is published, which is the 20th of October, which is the single most important thing that will now happen to this government in the next few months, whether when that reality dawns on you as a party and the public, when they see what that will mean, including 25% cuts in non-protected departments over the next 3 years, which is a more ambitious cut strategy than we've seen in this country since the war. When that happens, whether you as a party have the resolve to see it through, or whether in fact significant differences start to emerge between you and the Conservatives, and what happens in your relationship with public opinion once that starts to see through. Because the essential gamble that you took in these negotiations was to strike a compromise on constitutional issues, to strike a compromise on the other big public policy issues that face the country, but on the essential agenda of deficit reduction to go with the Conservatives and eliminate the structural deficit in this Parliament, which is cuts, fiscal tightening equivalent to more than 6% of GDP in this Parliament, rather than with the Labour Party that would have been at a still very ambitious but a significantly slower rate. That will be the test. Now, we've sort of been here before. As AJP Taylor famously said, history doesn't repeat itself, historians repeat each other. But nonetheless, I do recommend to you Roy Hattersley's Life of Lloyd George. It's always good seeing what's happened in the past when you faced similar situations. The Liberals have been in coalition with the Conservatives once before, for 4 years in peacetime, for 4 years after the First World War. It didn't end happily. Your party went down from about 260 seats in the House of Commons before the 1918 election to 40 seats in 1924. And when it all collapsed in 1922, this was Lloyd George's verdict. Lloyd George's verdict then was that the party had fallen to the fate of the Eskimo, he said. And I quote, "Life in an ice house is very hard to manage. If the temperature is too high, the igloo melts. If it's too low, the occupants freeze." Hattersley's remark is, Lloyd George lost the Liberals without gaining the Tories. In his pursuit of coalition government, he had veered wildly from side to side of the political divide and in the end had been swallowed up by the gulf which separated the parties. However, not everybody left the sinking ship. On the day that he resigned, Winston Churchill issued a fulsome statement. Today, declared Churchill, when men who fawned upon him praised his errors, who climbed into place in Parliament upon his shoulders, have cast him aside, I am still his friend and lieutenant. Well, that lasted for another 2 years before Churchill joined the Tories. And as they say, the rest is history. So you must be hoping that history doesn't come round for a second time this time.
In Scotland, they have coalitions all the time, as far as I can see, and Jo's here to tell us about them.
Yes, well, in Scotland, we, of course, have a new, fairer electoral system already for electing members of the Scottish Parliament. And since that has been formed in 1999, there has not been a single party majority, nor is it really likely that there will be, particularly given that we already have very much a four-party system in Scotland. And indeed, in the first Parliament, we actually had a six-party system, with the Socialists and Greens having strong representation there, and now the Greens are reduced to two MSPs. I think what's interesting, what Andrew says, is about how two parties form a policy platform, because at the end of the day, we fight manifestos on our policies. Those are the issues that we want to implement, and therefore, in forming any kind of coalition, it's vital that there is that roadmap available. And the negotiations after the 1999 Holyrood elections led to a very strong partnership agreement between Labour and the Liberal Democrats, which set out line by line the different policies from each manifesto that would be implemented. And of course, anything that was out with the partnership agreement had to be negotiated and agreed as issues came up, because if it wasn't already agreed, then there was no guarantee and no assumptions that both parties would necessarily agree. I think one thing that's important to recognise within our system is that actually, in order to make that kind of coalition agreement work, a fixed-term parliament is essential, because you need to build trust on both sides, and therefore you need to know that while the things that you've negotiated in the agreement might not have happened quite immediately, that they will be delivered over the course of a whole parliament. And in fact, that was one of the things that meant that our Westminster system was not very well set up for coalitions, not just in terms of the voting system, but also in terms of this potential election at any time, which of course gives the opportunities for a larger partner in a coalition to otherwise just cut and run after they'd done the things that they wanted to do. So the fixed-term parliaments bill is very important. I think when we looked at the coalition agreement, it was actually the substance of that which convinced the parliamentary party that the right course of action was to go into coalition with the Conservatives. And I just have to pay tribute to Chris and the rest of the negotiating team, who managed, despite the fact that we have one MP to every sort of five Tory MPs or thereabouts, to create an agreement which does have massive chunks of Liberal Democrat policy running right through it. And you know, that gives us the opportunity to put our policies into practice. And at the end of the day, what do you come into politics to do? Yes, you can shout from opposition, but we want to actually deliver the things that we believe in. And in Scotland, we delivered free personal care, we delivered scrapping tuition fees, we delivered a much stronger Freedom of Information Act. That was with the Labour Party, actually, despite the fact that Tony Blair might not have been too keen on that. And importantly, we didn't get swallowed up by the Labour Party. Nobody suggests that that in Scotland there's no difference between the Lib Dems and Labour. We stand as very much independent parties. And I think actually the electorate is a bit more sophisticated than we sometimes give them credit for. They can understand that you go into an agreement with some other party, you don't agree with everything they say, you don't suddenly share all the same principles, but you can come to some accommodations. I think that we are actually experiencing a new politics. Now, we were promised a new politics at the election in the leadership debates, and I think the country got quite excited about the prospect of us doing politics slightly differently. And there's been a huge fixation about how the coalition is new, and that's a new way of doing politics. As Chris mentioned, it's actually only new to Westminster. It's not new to the rest of the world. But it's not the only thing that's different. Actually, Parliament is quite a different place since the election. For a start, there's 230 new MPs, And these new MPs are, some of them are younger, but even, you know, age aside, actually perhaps more more younger in mind and spirit and openness to modernising than the previous group of MPs. There are a group of MPs that have come in since the expenses scandal, and therefore they see the need for change much more clearly than I found in the last Parliament was the case. And I've certainly found that a very exciting place to be, seeing these new MPs from all sides of the House with their desire to make a difference and to change the way that we do politics, even in Parliament. And one of the changes that has been, I think, very influential and will continue to be, has been that we now elect the chairs and members of select committees, which sounds like a really geeky, unimportant change, until you realise that this used to be something that was in the patronage of the whips. And this used to be something where basically somebody just got chosen. And now the whole House votes on who these people should be. So if you want to be, you know, the Labour member or a chair of a select committee, you need to get Conservatives to vote for you too. And the House of Commons is so has been so unbelievably polarised and tribal, with very little opportunity for cross-party discussion outside of select committees or parliamentary, all-party parliamentary groups. And what we saw in the few weeks after the election was MPs from all parties having to go and speak to people from the other side of the House. And I just thought that was brilliant. And I think, and I hope, not in vain, I hope, that it will change slightly the culture of the chamber to be somewhat more like the European Parliament, whereby you may disagree with people, you may think they're absolutely wrong and have a very heated argument with them about it, but that can still be done with a measure of respect. Respect that they're coming from a genuinely held different political viewpoint. And I think that's something which would be important. Because at the end of the day, people who get elected to Parliament, you know, much as, you know, the media would say otherwise, they don't do it for the money. They don't do it for sort of power necessarily, particularly not typically when they join the Liberal Democrats. But people do it because they want to make a difference. And we may disagree about how we want to do that and what the things are that are most important, but there is a genuine desire for public service there. And so I think that slight change will help to change the culture of the way we do politics. And people like this. People, the public out there, they didn't like our old adversarial system. They didn't like the fact that on 35% of the vote, you would have a government with 55% of the seats. They didn't think that worked. They were not enamoured with that. Now, they do like the idea of politicians working together. I mean, that is shown to be very popular. And in fact, one of the things I loved in the election was during the leaders' debates, the BBC had this, the worms. I don't know if any of you saw this, but they would track what the public opinion did at different points in the leaders' comments. And whenever Nick Clegg talked about working with other parties, the Lib Dem worm went sort of through the roof. People like that. Now, Andrew's right, they might not like cuts. But those cuts are necessary, and those cuts would have happened under a government of any colour or any combination of colours. And the argument about the scale of the cuts is actually not as far apart as is being painted sometimes, because Andrew talks about 25% cuts in non-protected government departments. Well, I'm working with Vince in the biz department, and I know that under the previous government, that department was having to prepare for cuts of between 20 and 25% anyway. So whatever the colour of the government had been, there would have been these massive cuts, which I accept the public will not like. But we have to decouple that from whether or not they actually like the idea of parties working together, because I think the two are separate things, and I think they do like coalitions. Do politicians like it? Well, it's challenging. It's not easy. It's not comfortable. You have to find ways through things. But at the same time, any government has got arguments and discussions and points of disagreement within its government. What I quite like is that we can be more honest and open about where those lines are. And there's actually quite a creative tension within government as you have to argue the point for the different policies. So we promised as Liberal Democrats, through Nick and the leaders' debates, that we would have new politics at the election. I think we are delivering new politics after the election. I think it is very good for Britain. I also happen to think it's very good for the Liberal Democrats.
That's absolutely marvellous. It's a record. We've actually got through the main speeches in less than half the time we have available, which is brilliant because it gives us a chance for a real debate. But first I'll ask the three panellists if they've got any point they'd like to pick up with either of their two co-panellists.
I'm telling you. Believe it or not, for those of you who are historians, Andrew is a very good historian. It's just unfortunately this particular essay on liberal history gets a gamma. Because the reality about the 1920s that we should remember is, first of all, the party was divided. It was divided by what had happened in 1916 when Lloyd George had to displace Asquith. I personally think that was essential if we were going to win the war, but it left us with a divided party where we fought each other at the subsequent elections. Divided parties have enormous costs. This party today is united. Enormous difference between now and then. Second slight point that Andrew glosses over, and that is that there was, in the intervening period between the great liberal victories in 1906, 1910, and then through the First World War, there was, of course, universal suffrage introduced for the election at the end of the First World War, and even a limited vote for women. And the reality, universal manhood suffrage, that enormously increased the electorate, and it did mean that there was, for the first time, a serious introduction of class politics, which went on to reach its apogee in 1945 and has been in retreat in this country ever since 1970. And what you see today in liberalism is a cause, a crusade of conscience and reform, which gets back the idea that attitudes, ideas, values matter once again in politics and not merely class interest. And it's an entirely different circumstance to the circumstances that the Liberal Party faced in the early 1920s. So that was the first point I'd like to make. And as Simon Hughes would say, 17thly. Let me briefly make a point about the deficit reduction. I think all of the parties were over-optimistic before the election about the ease with which they would be able to deliver public expenditure cuts as part of the deficit reduction. All of us, including Labour, actually promised 70% correction of the fiscal deficit through public expenditure cuts. By comparison, Ken Clark in the early 90s did about 50%. Even Mrs. Thatcher was about in the same ballpark. So if we're guilty of being overambitious on public spending, it's a charge which Labour too and Andrew's government has to plead guilty to as well. I certainly think it's important to have clear goals in deficit reduction, absolutely crucial in the circumstances that we faced immediately at the end of the election campaign. All the Labour leadership candidates now want to brush over a simple, single fact, which is that in the weekend after our general election, every finance minister in Europe, including Labour's Alistair Darling, went and met and announced a €500 billion rescue package to stop the contagious financial crisis that was sweeping through southern Europe. Now, I think we had to react to that. And the idea that somehow we were fundamentally different is nonsense. We had a larger budget deficit than any other country in Europe, bar one, the largest budget deficit of the 20 developed countries, the G20, and we had a higher level of debt, for example, than Spain, which was clearly affected by the crisis. We had to deal in the national interest with the circumstances as they were, not the circumstances that Andrew and his colleagues would like to imagine they were. We have to deal with reality. They can go off and play games in opposition if they want. That's a different game. We've stopped playing it here in the Liberal Democrats, and we're not about to start again.
I think, I wasn't going to use my time, but I've got to reply to that. You can't expect me just to sit here as a kind of stuffed dummy. I've always thought with Chris that the old saying applies in spades. He's more sure of everything than I am of anything. If I had Chris's sense of certainty about how one deals with everything from electoral reform to the budget deficit to the rewriting of history and what might have happened, I mean, have confidence in yourself. If you had actually been a strong party, an independent party in 1918, just possibly this century of very class-based and class-divided politics might not have happened. You weren't sort of innocent victims. You were a party to it too. But let me just respond to his two points. The key thing about 1918, for historical record, is that Lloyd George chose to fight the first election. This was an election, not the, having to deal with the crisis of the First World War. He chose to fight the first election by dividing the Liberals and allying with the Conservatives. I don't think any serious historian doubts that the historical development of your party would have been radically different if instead he had gone back with Asquith and the Liberals had fought the 1918 as an independent force. And, of course, the rest of the Liberal Party wouldn't have come in behind a government which was formed with the Conservatives. Now, had that happened, then a lot of this class-based politics, which Chris has been referring to, may not have taken place. You know, the great tragedy of the interwar period and afterwards is that the voice of liberalism was so weak. I don't think any serious historian can divorce the fact that it was so weak by the decision of Lloyd George to go with the Conservatives in 1918. So far as the deficit reduction is concerned, he's absolutely right. It's tough. You know, I've sat around the cabinet table and we were discussing what was going to be our agenda of cuts and fiscal tightening, and it was going to be very, very tough indeed. I was Transport Secretary and we were looking at very significant cutbacks, and it would have been difficult. But on Joe's point about we're all going to have to cut, you know, we do need a bit of numeracy here. There is a huge difference between fiscal tightening equivalent to 80 billion during the course of 4 years and fiscal tightening which is going to amount to 120 billion. That is the difference between the positions that the party's adopted, and you decided, this is your free decision as a party, to go with the 120 billion. The point I'm making, I was just trying to inject facts and not sort of great rah-rah speeches of Chris's kind, because let's be clear, it is the facts. You know, I'm a rationalist who believes that policy matters and that facts win through. The biggest fact that you're going to have to, I should say it's not always true in politics, but I fondly believe it may be. The facts that you're going to have to grapple with over the next 4 years, on which this coalition will stand or fall and your party will succeed or fail, is whether you can in fact carry through cuts on that scale, fiscal tightening on that scale, be true to your values, hold your party together with the Conservatives and carry the country with you. That is a simple description of the political terrain as it exists at the moment. There's no point denying it. It's the biggest challenge that you face.
Joe, would you like to get a word in edgeways?
Well, actually, I think I'd like to hear from the audience.
OK, let's go to the audience. We've got roving mics and a lot of hands up. Would one of the mics like to rove over to see this lady here at the front? And then we'll move over there. Usual thing, you're welcome to make a statement. I don't see why you should only ask questions, but please keep it short. Lots of people want to speak.
No, it's a question. Many times I've heard since I've come about the government having...
Can you hear? Oh.
No, that's better.
Many times since I've come here, I've heard you discussing a five-year plan. You've got 5 years in which to demonstrate how important the principles of the Liberal Party are. I don't actually have 5 years, because in 7 months' time, I have to fight a local election. What I'd like to hear from the party is, I don't actually perceive much difference actually in the way that politics is operating locally, except we all have significant cuts. And I really would like to hear from you about the way the future of local politics. I'm a unitary authority councillor. I'm also a town councillor. How's that going to work for me in 7 months' time?
Okay, that's a very, very fair question. And let me make one simple point. I think that there's also a lot of evidence in recent years that the electorate have been deciding on how to vote on the basis of who is most appropriate for each level of government. We tend as a party, or we have tended as a party in the past, to record our highest share of the votes in local government elections, followed by Westminster elections, with European elections as the lowest share of the votes of those three. And there is, I think, quite a lot of evidence on the doorstep, that's my impression, that these are people who are taking deliberate decisions. And I believe that we are going to be unpopular at Westminster. We're going to be unpopular nationally as we grapple with this deficit, because we are converting something that people understand in theory that they want to cut the deficit into practice. And as soon as you do that, they say, well, I'm not sure I like that cut, or I'm not sure I like that cut. The reality is that we are going to become unpopular in those circumstances, but I do not believe that means that you are a lost cause, far from it, when it comes to fighting next May. because what we have seen over and over again is a gradual separation of local election results from the national picture. And at the last general election, when you had local elections up on the same day, you saw all sorts of councils going in the opposite direction to the Westminster vote. You've seen it in this city over many, many years. And where we fight as Liberal Democrats, you know we win. Those areas that are putting out the focus leaflets, that are making the points about local policy, that are getting their face through the doors, they're going to hold and win and gain. And we will make some gains, we may make some losses next May, but the reality is it's going to be more down to local campaigning efforts than anything else, and that's been the case for a long time.
Why don't you just bellow? Oh no, we've got a mic here, that's right.
Jonathan Hunt. Well, we're having history lessons about coalitions. The one that most appeals to me is 1945, where the junior partner of a coalition actually worked on independent policies, radical reforming revolutionary policies that have, you know, led the field for, you know, almost two generations. That was the Labour Party and its manifesto then. And I would like to, suggest that is what this party should be doing, is in parallel with working in government, is also for the party to be developing policies like that for which we can win the next election. I mean, electorates don't look back, they're not very grateful, they look forward, and we need a set of policies that will appeal to them, not just sort of, please sir, me too, I was part of it, sort of Corporal Jones sort of line. We've got to be, thinking something new, something revolutionary, and that has to be on, and to contradict our leader, I'm afraid, that has to be on the, if you like, in shorthand terms, the left of politics, because the centre and the centre-right are far too crowded and there's no room for any more.
Well, I think there is an excellent point there about policy development being incredibly important. It's vital that we have a strong Liberal Democrat identity at the next election, and distinctive radical policies will be an important part of that. And in fact, conference will be playing a very important part in that over the next few years. And of course, it's one of the pitfalls of government, if you like, that, when you haven't been in government for 80 years at a UK level, then, while we've adapted policies to fit the times, we've also had some policies that, we've had on our policy book for quite a long time, and given that we're going to put some of them into practice, we'll definitely need a new refreshed policy manifesto, and that's a nice problem to have.
You shouldn't sell yourself short, though. I mean, the great ideas that the junior coalition partner, which I assume you mean was Labour in 1945, was working on, out of Beveridge and Lloyd, Beveridge and Keynes in the 1920s and 1930s. It was a great movement in thinking in social liberalism, which is what paved the way for social democracy in 1945, every bit as much as movements of thought inside Labour circles. Look back to Beveridge, Keynes, and you'll get a lot of the inspiration for where you should be going in the next 10 years as well as the last 80.
But surely, up to 45, there was only one possible policy the Cabinet was pursuing, which was winning the war, and therefore you could have social policies which were quite separate. To have the Liberal Democrats coming out with a completely different set of policies from the Conservative coalition-led coalition would be rather grotesque, would it not, without a war on?
Well, that's not actually what happens on the continent. I mean, you've got to get used to the fact that every other democracy in Europe has this pattern of coalition governments which come together in order to implement a particular program, and then at the end of that coalition government they break off, they fight as independent parties, and they reform again. Sometimes they say, it's quite rare actually, yes, we're going to definitely continue with this particular coalition. It's much more usual that they come up with an independent program. And I see no reason why we don't do the same thing again. I think we have to make sure the policy development is going on. The key thing for any successful party is to face up to the challenges that face our people at any given time. I think many of those, some of those, for example, on climate change, are going to be the same, frankly, in 5 years' time as they are today. I don't think that even the greenest government in the world is going to be able to lick that one in 5 years. But there are going to be areas where we are going to be able to develop our policy, and I think we will fight on that well-known Liberal Democrat slogan, a record of action and a promise of more.
Okay, gentleman there. Mike is almost with you.
I want to ask a question about the electoral impact of the new politics, because I think if the Lib Dems, and if we're honest, that actually our biggest parliamentary gains came first in 1997, and it was on a wave of actually an anti-Tory alliance. And if you look at the figures and the numbers of what happened in May, that many of our holds, you actually had Tory advances, but you had Lib Dem MPs hanging on because of the ability to squeeze the Labour vote and actually decimate it and destroy it in many areas. And Chris's seat in Eastleigh is a good example of that. And actually where we went into reverse and where we lost seats, perhaps surprisingly, in places like Rochdale and Chesterfield, is where the Tory vote went up. So I think the evidence points to Lib Dem MPs win, of course, because of a local record, but they also win because there's an anti-Tory majority in that seat. My principal concern about the electoral impact of this coalition is if that's set to unravel, then there'll be a serious impact on the Lib Dems' parliamentary representation going forward. And I'd like the panel's idea, particularly Joe and Chris, on how we best combat that threat.
Well, first of all, I don't see that if you were to go to my electors in Eastleigh and ask them why have they voted for Chris Huhne in the election, why did they vote Liberal Democrat, I don't think they would say, I am part of a great anti-Tory coalition. I think they would have a load of other reasons, including policy ideas that have floated nationally, including Nick Clegg's performance in the TV debates, including local track record as a constituency MP, all sorts of factors. Yes, obviously, in the system that we have, and then spiel forward to look at what might happen in the AV referendum in May, but in the system that we have, we do confront people with an appalling and very negative choice, which is if you don't think your party has a chance of winning in your area, then you basically often end up trying to make a decision about a second best party because you're voting against the party you don't want to win. But that applies, frankly, to Tory voters, to nationalist voters, to Green voters, just as much as it does to Labour voters. And I want to see a system that allows people to vote positively for the party that they want rather than negatively against the party that they fear. And that is an enormous step forward with the alternative vote, which is why I think we need to campaign extremely hard. I think we're going to win that campaign. If we don't win that campaign and we end up with the sort of situation that you're talking about, then remember that it won't just be an anti-Tory. There will also be people who will be voting for Lib Dems because they don't want Labour to win. And one of the reasons, I think, why we have lost a certain tranche of our support immediately after the election is because inevitably there are, in Liberal Democrat support, people whose second preferences do vary. And as soon as you start struggling with the realities of one coalition partner rather than another and with the realities of government, some of those people will temporarily go elsewhere. But I have no reason to believe that they won't come back with a good record of government and with some imaginative thinking, as this party is perfectly capable of doing, about what we ought to offer to the election, to the electorate at the next election.
I think... Sorry to interrupt Chris's applause there. I think that it'd be false to paint the election as saying that actually we just held on a lot of seats and without recognising that there were a lot of seats that we just missed out on. And in fact, there were more seats this time that we just missed out on than that we won by a small amount. And so, you know, places like Hull, like Falmouth and Camborne, you know, 66 votes, or Camborne and Redruth as it is now, Ashfield, Oldham. You know, there was a lot of places that we narrowly failed to take the seats. But on the same night that we were winning against the Conservatives in Wells and Eastbourne, we were also winning against Labour in Burnley and Redcar. And Chris is absolutely right to say that the whole tactical voting thing is quite a pernicious element of our electoral system that we wouldn't want to have in an ideal system. But unfortunately, people are forced into that. And if people's vote is to count, then parties effectively have to campaign within the system that we have. And hopefully, if we win the referendum next May, then that at least will be taken out of it. But I don't think it would be fair to say that all Lib Dem voters are anti-Tory. I mean, certainly in my area, then people were voting to make sure that we didn't have a Labour government back in. And make sure that Labour didn't regain the seat. So different factors apply in different seats. And from my summer tour that I was out and about in the constituency over the summer, while the deficit is a massive issue and the CSR is a massive issue, there's also people concerned about the local sports centre and about whether or not this massive supermarket building is going to go ahead. And so those local issues are still going to be really important when it comes to people deciding how they cast their votes at elections between now and the next general election.
Lady there. Yes, lady there.
Thank you very much. I'm concerned about the quality of our representation. I do believe that politics should be of the people, and Nick Clegg yesterday very graphically described how it affected him when he saw the floods in Pakistan. They weren't a theory anymore. I'm very concerned a lot of our politicians are theoreticians. They don't have ordinary schools, they don't have ordinary backgrounds. We have 26 millionaires in the cabinet. We are predominantly white, male, middle class, middle-aged in government. I don't see how you can change that, but I don't feel it's representative.
I'm going to start because Jo's going to have the rousing finale on this because she has very good, strong views about it. But I'm going to start by simply pointing out an obvious point. I think that this party and other parties need to be far more representative of the people that we represent. And I put my hand up as a middle-aged, middle-class man in a suit who, probably shouldn't be here as a result. Sorry about that. But I think that the big change which we would have if we moved towards a different electoral system is that local parties would be much more open to selecting candidates who come from a much wider range of backgrounds, because they wouldn't be drawn, and there's quite a lot of the political science literature evidence on this, they wouldn't be drawn repeatedly to going for the lowest common denominator. So under all proportional representation systems, including the ones that are operating in this country, in Scotland, in London, for example, for the Greater London Assembly, there's much better gender balance and there's much better ethnic balance than there is under first past the post, and that's a really important reason for continuing the process of electoral reform.
Well, can I obviously can't comment on your internal selection processes, but it's clear to me from the Labour Party that you would not have had as many women in Parliament representing that party if there hadn't been all women shortlists. And you've always been against that in your party, and I think that's part of the reason why you have so few women in Parliament at the moment. And I think you need to reflect on whether there are changes which you can make which might ensure that you have a more representative parliamentary party than you've got at the moment. The point, of course, that Chris is making is it's only true of more proportional systems. There's no reason why a change in the electoral system from the current system to the alternative vote, which maintains single-member seats, should lead to any change in party selection processes, unless you do something which strongly brings that about.
Well, I agree entirely with the question that this is a very important issue, because Parliament, while better than it was, is still not nearly representative enough of the communities that we serve. And perhaps I'm doing my bit for that as a youngish woman who went to a state school. But even just in terms of background, it's absolutely full of people who are middle class. So it's not just gender or BME or disability. I mean, there's a whole range of different groups that are actually massively underrepresented. And I sat last session on the Speaker's Conference, which looked at some things that we could do to improve this. And part of that's about making politics more accessible and easier to fit around different lives. Parliament has, as of this month, finally got a nursery in it, which, you know, as a workplace with several thousand people working in it, is long overdue. So there are small changes that Parliament can make. But Andrew's quite right to say that he can't really comment on our internal procedures, because he says, well, all-women shortlists was the answer for Labour. All-women shortlists wouldn't have helped us at all at this election. Because at this election, sadly, we don't get to see the value of this, but we actually sorted out the issue with getting women candidates into good seats. For the first time, we had half of the seats where our MPs stood down selected women without an all-women shortlist in sight, purely on merit. More than a third of our target seats had women candidates. So the investment that we have made as a party into getting more women approved and selected has been paying off. Now, of course, if for a party that doesn't have safe seats, then that actually doesn't guarantee that you will get more women. And so when people talk about all-women shortlists as an equality guarantee, I frankly have to stop myself from laughing, because there's no guarantee if you don't have safe seats. And we don't want to have safe seats anyway. We don't want that kind of electoral system. But therefore, you can't guarantee it. What you can do is make sure that you have a diverse set of candidates. And what we've done with women, we need to do, particularly with BME communities, because that's an absolute scandal within the party. But I have to say, it's not something the party has done a lot about until 2 years ago. So we can hardly sit here and complain that we haven't got the result that we want when we haven't put the effort and the resource in until very, very recently, and of course too late for most of the selections in the most winnable seats. And I mean, the question was, I don't know if there's anything that we can do about it. What can we do about it? Well, actually, we can do something about it. Every single person in this room can do something about it, because you're all out there in local parties, you're all seeing people that have joined the Lib Dems or maybe haven't yet joined the Lib Dems, but who would be good representatives and perhaps come from a group that isn't currently massively represented. Well, speak to people, encourage them to join, to get involved, to stand, and direct them towards the support that is available within the party, because we've shown that that can work, but we do need the help of everybody within the party to make that happen.
Gentleman over there, even one of the other questioners was pointing to him, so he must have a great deal of grassroots support in this hall. Was it... Bill Rogers? Oh my God, hello. Fourth of On Equals, what a great book. You should buy that, it's on Amazon.
Andrew, you said, we know, you said very briefly, you made an important contribution in what turned out to be a failure, but bringing the Lib Dems together with the Labour Party in May, and you've been talking about the likely shortcomings and the dangers, you very rightly say, to the present coalition. But in 5 years' time, there will be another election. There might be another hung parliament. Could you say briefly exactly how Labour should change to make it possible an alliance, a coalition between the Labour Party and the Lib Dems in 5 years' time? How should Labour change?
Actually, that's a very good question, Bill. You're right. and therefore, I'm not going to fully answer it. let me just make a point about what happened in May. My own view is that we would now have a Lib Dem Labour government if the numbers had been slightly different in May. Let's be clear. When you talk about fundamental changes, sometimes you can rewrite history. If there had been another 10 or 15 seats between us, the dynamics of the negotiation with exactly the same policies in place would have been very, very different. The concern which was felt on the Lib Dem side was, I mean, Chris can speak for himself, but it was in good part to do with judgments that were made. I think they were incorrect judgments, but they were judgments that were made on the parliamentary viability of a Labour-Lib Dem programme. In terms of the actual policies at stake, the policy prospectus was perfectly viable. And indeed, you know, I mean, though I'm now in a non-party think tank, so I'm slightly rising above these things, it takes a bit of time, actually, to get in this mindset. As I look back on it, I don't think that there were policy obstacles. And on the critical issue of the economy, let's be clear, as I keep coming back to, this is the critical issue of this Parliament. The critical issue of this Parliament is the £120 billion worth of fiscal tightening that is going to take place in the next 4 to 5 years. My own judgment, and it hasn't changed in retrospect, is that we would have been better off, it would have been more balanced to have gone for a halving of the deficit in the course of this Parliament. On the balance of all the evidence as to what works internationally, the state of the economy, the very sluggish position we have in respect to growth at the moment, that would have been better. It was hugely ambitious than taking that figure and adding another 50% to it, which is what the Conservatives did and which you've decided to go along with them. So on the big things about this May, I don't think that there is a fundamental changes that are needed. One or two things that will need to change, though. If multi-party politics is here to stay in parliamentary terms, it's obviously been here with the electorate. Actually, all the way back to 1918, the third party has always had a substantial body of electoral support. If it's going to be present in parliamentary terms, then my own judgment is that the time has definitely come to change the electoral system, that it's simply not correct and it's not justifiable to have an electoral system which means that the third party, which has a body of support between 15 and 25%, as the Lib Dems have, is constantly on the verge of total annihilation in parliamentary terms, or only modest representation, which is what happens with the current electoral system. 1970, which Chris referred to earlier, remember, the Liberals then, substantial force, very substantial public following, 6 seats in the House of Commons, and only up to whatever it was, 11 in 1974. This is not, and you know, if you look at what happened in the last election too, though the two-party Labour-Conservative vote was at a low since 1945 of 65%. In fact, of course, Labour and the Conservatives increased their share of seats. So the big thing I think we're going to have to come to terms with is electoral reform. I have been a supporter of electoral reform. I haven't changed my view since I was a member of this party. And I think a very big test of the Labour leader elected next week is whether we stick to the statements that we made at the election about our support for electoral reform, and that we once and for all sort out this question so that we have a stable electoral system going forward that properly recognises the role of the third party.
Can I squeeze in one last question? Sorry.
Can I just quickly come back on that? I mean, first of all, on the issue of the negotiations, I think that it wasn't just a question of the parliamentary arithmetic. I think that Labour needed to have enormous willpower on the parliamentary arithmetic we had in order to deliver. It would have meant an incredibly demanding schedule of getting the votes through the Commons. And the second negotiating session that we had, and Andrew will remember this because we were on opposite sides of the table at that negotiating session, we opened, and it was actually much more fruitful than the first negotiating session with Labour. But it was against a background already where the Today programme that morning had carried David Blunkett saying that he didn't think that there was going to be, it was possible. And we'd already had by that stage John Reid, David Blunkett, and if I remember, Jack Straw, all saying that Labour had to go into opposition and there wasn't really a possibility. So the idea that we could really summon up the political will in the Labour Party to deliver on that very hard parliamentary arithmetic didn't seem to me to be credible. And we were facing, remember, by that stage, a real financial crisis. Whatever is said, you don't get every finance minister in Europe to get in a room to announce a €500 billion package without there being a reason for it. And that's exactly the situation that we were dealing with. Now, I'll just make one other point on Andrew's point about the deficit. The reason why Alistair Darling didn't go far enough in penciling in the numbers that he did was simply because in the out years it wasn't credible that there would be a fall in the debt relative to GDP. And George Osborne thought very strongly that it was important that by the time of the end of the Parliament we should be able to show that we'd stopped the debt getting worse. And I think that is a legitimate objective. I think it's one which shows that there would be stability back in the public finances. But I have to say to you, I spent 10 years as writing about economics for The Guardian. I spent an awful lot of my career writing about economics, about chancellors, about finance ministers. I have never known, in the entire period I've been writing about economics, one red book the same as the next. And any chancellor has to take account of circumstances, has to reassess. If you're setting out to sail from here to Birkenhead and the wind changes, you're going to have to go about and take a new tack to get to your objective. The objective will stay the same, but you have to make sure that you get there in a way that delivers both the deficit reduction that we have to deliver and growth, because you don't get the deficit reduction unless you get growth. Growth is necessary to get the tax revenue up, and it's necessary to get the benefit payments down as unemployment falls. So both of those things are important, and the financial markets will be looking for both of those things. And I think government ministers are very aware of that.
I think Chris has just said something very, very significant, actually, which you were not supposed to say, I thought, at fringe meetings of this kind, which is that I take him to say that if growth is in fact low, then it may be that the cuts will be scaled back.
That's, I think I gave you a nautical, I thought Chris was saying, which is a very, very image.
Which is an immensely significant statement. All I can say is, I hope it's correct, because if growth is very low, and we are faced with the threat of double dip or actual long-term low growth, then that is the situation we appear to be facing. I very much hope that some of the decisions that have been taken so far are retaken.
Well, be careful, because you have to assess these things as you go along, and you have to look at what the threats are. And the Labour Party's judgment of what those threats were, for example, in the immediate wake of the election, is, my view, fundamentally flawed. And if we had done what the Labour Party now says, what Ed Balls wants us to do, we would have a much worse double-dip recession than anybody's had in years. The shortest way to a double-dip recession is to lose so much confidence in the financial markets that bond rates go up, short-term interest rates go up, and we end up with a double-dip recession. So there is a balance to be struck here. There is a judgment to be made. You have to wait and look at the circumstances at the time. You cannot, I'm afraid, outside the seminar room, set out economic rules in quite such a clear-cut way as Andrew's suggesting.
Well, this, I'm afraid we're over time already. I've been chairing this event since roughly the Campbell Bannerman era, and it's much the liveliest of all of them. And so I'd like us all to thank our three splendid speakers for a really very interesting.